I tried and failed to hitch a ride out of town. But in classic Latin American style, no one rocked up.
Everything fun makes God sad. And it confuses me that the person upstairs created all this stuff and then said, don't touch any of it.
This bird is ruined for us. This animal is ruined for us. You've tainted him with your non-scientific musical interactions.
Listening to All the Best, I'm Jess Hamilton. It's our second instalment of stories that premiered at our live listening party at 107 Projects in Sydney, where we invited an audience to spend a night with All the Best. This week, we'll be taking you on midnight adventures around the world, skipping through volcanic craters in Guatemala and regretting a sex toy lost in London. But before we get to that, we're kicking things off in a small student town in Sweden. When Selena moved from sunny Sydney to the dark depths of a Swedish winter, she sometimes asked herself why she decided to migrate, even if only for 6 months, to a place where the night never really transitions into day. But her experience and her perspective all changed when she met the Nightingale Man.
So a scientist wants to know the answer, why birds sing, and this you can read in most biology textbooks. Birds sing to defend territories and attract mates. The male birds are doing the singing, and the females are listening to see if they like it, and other males are listening to see if you're encroaching on my territory. And that's the generally accepted explanation, and it's true.
In 2014, I was living and studying in a small town in Sweden. I lived in a tiny, single-room apartment with a frail single bed. It had been advertised as student accommodation, but it was actually a repurposed hotel room on a sterile, grey street. When I moved there, it was deep winter, like Swedish winter. Everything was dark and frozen, and there was not a single bird. For the length of my exchange, I found the Swedish town boring and stuffy, and I found it particularly difficult to make friends with Swedes. I felt like I wasn't in my natural habitat.
Why does a nightingale need to sing all night, whereas a hermit thrush just needs to sing a few phrases during the day? It's for the same function, doing the same thing, but using very different tools. Why this specific difference? Where does the nature of the difference come from? And that's a question, an aesthetic question, that most biologists don't look deeply into.
The uni subjects I was studying had nothing to do with birds or why they sing. But on one afternoon, we were invited to hear a guest lecturer speak on that exact topic. I had no roots in biology or ornithology, but I decided to go along and listen to Professor David Rothenberg from the US, a Harvard graduate and a professor in music and philosophy, but with a special pursuit.
What do I think of the term interspecies musician? You know, that's a kind of interesting word because no one knows what it means. And, you know, is that the same as a multicultural musician or an intercultural musician? Or, you know, I like the idea.
David plays jazz with animals, birds, insects, even whales. And the beautiful thing is that according to him, sometimes these animals sing back. His most responsive collaborator is the nightingale. I was totally absorbed by his lecture. He showed videos of notes coming out of his clarinet and birds acknowledging him, heads nodding, beaks chirping, and then releasing their own bird song in return, like in this clip from the BBC.
This interspecies jamming session so excited David that he embarked on a quest to commune with as many birds as possible.
So I listened to the musical call and response, but I wasn't sure I could hear what David was claiming. That the birds he played with were recognizing his music and singing back. He wrapped up the lecture, but before packing up, David mentioned he was going to Berlin that weekend. He was planning a nocturnal mission to chase after nightingales in a particular park where they nest for only 3 weeks of the year. I was pretty desperate for a change of scenery, so I asked, can I join? It's a Friday night in Berlin, and around me drunk people stumble over broken glass stomped into the pavement, chanting and celebrating in big groups. This particular night is May 9th, also known as Victory Day. It's the anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany, the end of the Second World War. Everyone is awake, and the whole city is one giant, noisy, overwhelming party. I finally spot David. He's brought a few others along, and together we head towards the park, Treptow Park, where the nightingales nest year after year, after migrating from Africa, often back to the very same tree. I really don't know what to expect. On the way, David pauses. He tells us he can't guarantee anything.
When you deal with nature, anything could happen. Maybe the birds won't sing. Maybe they'll be spooked by all these people. Maybe it'll start to rain. Maybe they'll just be done with singing for the day or for the season. So you never know if it's going to work the way you expect. There always is the opportunity and likelihood of uncertainty and surprise.
Young Russian and German men scuffle around us. They're heading towards Treptow Park as well. There's a famous Soviet monument in there, and the noisy crowds are wandering towards it like pilgrims. It really feels like the worst night to do this. It's cold and wet and unsettled, and there's noise everywhere. Not exactly the magical nightingale jaunt I'd expected. Nevertheless, we march on, disappearing into Treptow Park. Before we go any further, there are some cool and weird things you need to know about nightingales. Just in case, like me before I met David, you thought nightingales were mythical.
You know, one scientific paper determined that in the midst of a nightingale song, they make whistles and clicks, like boo, 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 boo. So the Megarynchos, the common nightingale, has like up to 200 or 300 separate songs it sings. And Lucinia Lucinia, the thrush nightingale, has maybe 50 or so. And that one sounds more like a DJ scratching records and more jarring and percussive. And the other one has many, many more different kinds of songs. And they have so, they sing so emphatically throughout the night, on and on and on. And they're in the same place every night. So this is also kind of unique. You can rehearse with a bird. You can plan the show and be pretty sure that when you go back the night of the show, the same bird's going to be there, ready for you.
But it's more than their song range and ability that attracts David to them. It's also their attitude. Because when it comes to the nightingale's song, David believes there's more to it than just territorial protection and female attraction. He thinks the nightingale's relationship to music is more complex and maybe more human.
They make this sound, like the brrr sound, this kind of bluesy, uneven note. Brrr, brrr. My friend Korhan calls it the booty sound. It's a sound that's the sexiest sound. Scientists have determined females really get excited when they hear this. But it's not done that often. And one scientist said, why doesn't the male nightingale just sing the booty sound over and over again? Like, boo, 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 boo. You know, duh, it's like a guitarist isn't going to use his wah-wah pedal constantly, unless it's Frank Zappa. But otherwise, you just do the cool licks once in a while. That gives them their power. And I think the nightingale in his song knows that and uses it a certain percentage of the time, just at certain moments. And that's very important to the effectiveness of that sound. But that's just a musical hunch.
In silence, we start to make our way through the park. I'm a bit nervous. I'm wondering how I ended up here and how far into the dark park we would be going. If you're not familiar with Treptow Park, it's huge. To borrow an overused analogy, it's about the size of 110 football fields, even though it's plonked in the middle of Germany's biggest city. We walk for a very, very long time, winding through trees, past ponds full of frogs. and soon the sounds of parties and street celebrations fade into the distance. We're all a bit unsure how to behave, whether we can talk, how slow or how fast we should be walking, and what we'll do if we don't find any nightingales. David has finally stopped under a specific tree, and we gather around him. It's almost pitch black where we're standing. At this point, it has started to properly rain, and I'm thinking that the loud Victory Day celebrations and the weather could leave us with no bird song. And I'm already reeling at the awkwardness of standing in the dark with eight strangers, possibly all having ended up here as I did, completely randomly, and now having to sit through the next half hour in the rain, growing more and more embarrassed for David. Because there's some contention around what David is doing exactly, and many biologists have doubts. Like, how can he know the birds are responding? How can he know the birds care or compute what he's doing? Well, the answer is he doesn't.
I'm interested in figuring out what the best nightingale song would be. And some people would talk about, like, you know, in biology books you read, oh, the bird with the longest song, the most complex song, or the loudest song has the most success at mating, and that's why it evolves through selective pressure, competition against each other for the attention of these females. And in fact, that's only been proven in a very small number of bird species. And in most bird species, like nightingales, there isn't any evidence that the more complex, more varied song leads to any more mating success. The differences are there, but we don't really know what makes the best nightingale song, if there is such a thing.
This is why David has spent so much of his life wondering if birds might be closer to humans than we think. Maybe they sing for beauty, for enjoyment, for pleasure, like us. In the forest, David plays a few notes, and we silently wait. Later, I went to visit David in Cold Spring. It's the town in upstate New York where he lives. Together, we reminisced about that night in Berlin. It was the first of many nights that David spent in Treptow Park that year. He'd found the bird he connected with the most, his best avian collaborator. This bird was the one. But good things never last.
The next year, we're all set. It's midnight. We're going to have a whole concert there. It's like 50 people and scientists show up. They're ready to record the same bird. Oh, look, you have this whole audience. Oh, we're interested in this bird. This is one of the best ones. Like, I know he's a good one. And I said, it's okay. We'll move. You know, we'll let you know. No, you got all these people here. You should stay. Well, wait a minute. Have you been playing with this bird already? Yes, we have. You know, whilst we were sampling the bird, you were sampling his own songs, playing it back. That's what really bothered them. It was like glimmers of a scientific experiment. And then this great nightingale scientist, Silke Kipper, said, this bird is ruined for us. This animal is ruined for us. You've tainted him with your non-scientific musical interactions. And, you know, I was very apologetic, and I said, we're going to stay out of Treptower Park from now on for this reason, because this is the one place you're studying it. But the other sense, I had to kind of laugh a bit, because this is a noisy park full of midnight parties and people singing and dancing. Like, the entire area is tainted by people. Like, these birds hang out with people. This is nothing like the wilderness, and it's interesting they picked this area. Now, since that year, they have renovated this place where the frogs were. I think the pond is gone. This year it was all under construction, so we didn't go back there. So I'm not sure the same great bird has come back.
It's been a couple of years, and David is still making music with nightingales. In fact, he's working on a documentary about his work and his pursuit of the best nightingale song, if there is such a thing. I hope his work continues because he taught me that your natural habitat isn't always where you're from or where you feel most comfortable, but simply where you land and decide to build a nest.
That piece was written and produced by Selena Shannon, with thanks to the Nightingale Man, David Rothenberg. You're listening to All the Best with a collection of nocturnal stories from our recent live listening event in Sydney. Our next story starts as a bustling town in Guatemala goes to sleep. When the music has finally stopped playing and the night owls have danced their way home to bed, Josephine Smart embarks on a midnight adventure and learns about risk, choice, and late night love. Just a heads up, this story has some adult themes.
Person is looking for a simple truth to live by. The only serious question is, who knows how to make love stay? They say we waste time looking for the perfect lover instead of creating the perfect love. But the bottom line is, people are never perfect. But love can be. Loving makes love. Loving makes itself. And perhaps a one-night love can be the perfect love, if we think of it that way. Isn't that a way to make love stay? This is a story about a love that lives and dies after dark, and that's the way that it stays. I'm in a tiny little town called San Marcos La Laguna in Guatemala. I'm travelling alone, barely 20 years old. San Marcos is beautiful. It's one of a handful of towns found on the banks of an enormous lake called Lago de Atitlan. The lake itself stretches out for miles, like an inland sea. It's surrounded by volcanoes, and pretty much everyone just gets around from town to town by boat. Earlier on this particular day, I tried and failed to hitch a ride out of town. But in classic Latin American style, no one rocked up, so I have no choice but to stay another night, because the next boat isn't due until the following morning. Thirsty, alone, and sick of small talk with fellow backpackers, I take myself to the one bar in town. There's one free seat, beside a guy who seems about my age. He looks up from his book. A gentle smile. I ask what he's reading. Tom Robbins, he says. Still Life with Woodpecker. Would I like some tequila? The bar comes alive. Bar closes. It's about 2 a.m. Our night isn't over. We decide to walk to the lake. The streets of San Marcos have a really intimate feel to them. No roads, just handmade, unpaved walkways, shaped by exotic plants and flowers that guide us along the path through lush jungle. The moon shines bright, full. We barely speak. We arrive at the edge of the lake, a cliff, a 10-meter drop into the dark depths below. We strip naked. We climb the slippery rocks, and at the top, we lie down under the stars. And then... It is perhaps the perfect love. A love that begins and ends after dark. A love that is left under the full moon. And maybe that's how to make love stay.
That story came from Josephine Smart with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon. It features lines from the book Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins. Josephine is a Melbourne-based producer and sound artist who also creates radio stories for an audio project called Dear Hello. You can hear more of her work at dear-hello.com. In our next story, Jessica Knight just can't seem to find something she holds quite dear. And a little warning, this piece also deals with some adult sexual themes.
I left my first and only silver bullet vibrator in a bedroom in a large share house in Kensal Green, North London to be exact. It was 2009 and I had been happily flipping my own bean for about 4 years. I did not realise my diminutive implement of happy endings was missing until I was in Manchester. I had expected to find it while unpacking my suitcase in the bedroom of the house that I would be living in and working as a nanny. I owed rent to the place in London and did not have the money. I could hardly call up Patrick, the creepy live-in landlord, and ask if he had come across my vibrator while cleaning out my side of the bedroom. It was not all that large or expensive, and I think the one AA battery that made it work had run out. I had become a little addicted to its magic as it had helped curb my initial intense homesickness and sexual frustration. Growing up in a Mormon household, that is, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the church had guidelines for every aspect of your life. One of the things that is considered wrong and unholy in the eyes of the Lord was masturbation. Yes, that delightful and harmless and disease-free pastime was considered gross and dirty. This is so funny and inexplicable to me now that I stand before you, a proud and defiant apostate of the church. Apostate is just a fancy way of saying that I decided through a process of transgressions and starting to think for myself that perhaps the church was not as great or good for me as my parents and relatives had tried to make me believe. There is a little pamphlet that you get as soon as you turn 12. It is called For the Strength of Youth. Inside the pages are some very lovingly written, if not condescendingly, information that invites you to dress modestly and save yourself, your sexy parts, and feelings for your husband or wife. It says you are not to arouse sexual feeling in your own body. In that pamphlet, you are told that homosexuality is a serious sin. You are told same-sex attraction saddens the Lord. It's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. This was a statement that I heard hundreds of times while growing up. Everything fun makes God sad, and it confuses me that the person upstairs created all this stuff and then said don't touch any of it. Masturbation was not discussed. Sex was not discussed. Consent and feeling safe or what constitutes a healthy relationship was not discussed. When I was 13, I was visiting my friend from church, Claire. She had an 11-year-old brother. While I was visiting, his parents caught him rubbing his crotch up and down the pantry door. He had obviously just discovered how amazing it felt. My friend and I watched as her brother was taken into the living room and sat down for a talk. We listened through the closed door. It was also funny to us. What was he doing that for? He could have simply been told that it was something to do in the privacy of your bedroom. He was instead told that it was not right. He was told that you just don't do it. Just don't do it is basically the cornerstone of the Mormon religion. I never understood why the church told young people not to masturbate. It was disease and pregnancy risk-free. Did you really want to be so very ignorant about what made you feel sexually wonderful on your wedding night? Wouldn't it be better if you could help steer your brand new spouse around the map of your body? Have the vocabulary and the confidence to say what you needed? No, refrain from all of it, and you shall remain pure in the eyes of the Lord. That creep was always watching you, with love and judgment. Which is why I did not discover the joys of self-love until I was 23, and had been living out of home since I was 16. The guilt and shame surrounding sex is something that I found difficult to unlearn. I got a job on the tropical holiday destination of the wealthy, Hamilton Island. The job involved cleaning up fancy apartments after rich young adults had partied and puked and left grand amounts of alcohol behind. Because when you are rich like that, you waste shit. The other cleaners and I would collect it and sneak it back to our rooms. I was still a virgin at this stage, and with the rumour that Hamilton Island had the highest rate of STDs in Australia, I got scared and decided I was not losing my V while on an island full of people who may or may not have the disease that gives you cluster warts on your genitals. It was there, with the warm breeze and sounds of the ocean floating through my window, that I slowly entered the wonder and majesty of self-reliant sexual pleasure. It was all very tentative at first, just a small and nervous hand caressing the stomach and slowly, very freaking slowly, it moved towards the front of my underwear, over the knickers, and until I found the spot that made my heart start humming, and a feeling that was so good, it amazed me that I had been made to feel so bad about it and put off doing it for so long. You could say that my working holiday on a tropical island was also a sort of honeymoon period for myself. It was not just that it felt good. Learning to make my own body feel sexually aroused was a huge deal. My body, up until that point, had never really felt like my own. It always felt like it was being shared or dissected or cut open, and my insides moved around or added to. My body was a slab of malfunctioning meat, and it was not unusual for it to be stripped down and stared at by multiple medical professionals at a time. It did not happen all at once, this awakening and feeling like my body could be sexual. When you are a kid with a body that is fascinating medically, it is easy to feel like you have no control over what happens to you and the skin that you are in. While on that tropical island, I discovered that I had way more control over my body than I was led to believe. Learning how to make this body sing a little, and learning what caresses worked and the ones that didn't, was like a whole new world was right under my nose, and I had the magic key. All that wasted time, reading the Book of Mormon in preparation for the end of days, all that time spent believing that Jesus is going to come to earth a second time, and you'd better be on the right and sexually pure side when he arrives, what a wasted adolescence. I wonder if I would not have been so sad had I known how to make myself feel like the second coming of Christ without the judgment and the end of the world. After that, I became aware that it was great for calming my nerves or helping me fall asleep at night. What an invention of the human nervous system. To think, all through university, I thought if I did anything like this, it indicated I could not get a boyfriend. Thanks to the church really pushing the whole heteronormative patriarchal only get sexy when it's your husband helping ideology. I thought fluffing my own cream puff indicated that I was as ugly and doomed to die alone as all those truly horrendous and lame Mormon dancers had me believing. It did not prove anything except independence. I did not need a girlfriend or a boyfriend. I only needed my clean hands, a sexy imagination, and a quiet moment.
That story was written by Jessica Knight with production assistance from Beck Fari and Selena Shannon. Jessica is a poet, writer, and zine maker based in Melbourne. Her three zines, Tongue Between Teeth, White and Red Cells, and All the Fussy People in a Fussy Little Sick, are available to purchase on the website mcdrawn.com. Her writing can be found on her blog, gremlinface82, at wordpress.com, and you can follow her on Twitter, at themess19, to get lots of tiny little poems and pictures of Merlin, her housemate's cat. Thanks again to all the storytellers who contributed to this episode and who made our Sydney listening party so special. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian state coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Beth Gibson is our SYN production manager. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.